Welcome to Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. This is episode 31. I'm Alan, and in this episode, I'll be using Piper Recording Studio to create another clone of myself.
Hello, and I'm Martin. I've given up Google search, and I'll be explaining how and why.
Hi, I'm Mark, and I've been judging a coding competition.
So you may recognise my voice from such videos as What Are Beans? And other silly things. I've written a blog post about this a long time ago. Ryan Sipes was CTO, I think, or community manager for Mycroft, which was the little open source lady cylinder. What do we call those nowadays?
Voice assistant.
Voice assistant.
Smart right. Speaker.
Okay.
Obsolete.
Too soon. Anyway, Mycroft was an open source project, and it aimed to do what all those other things do, but open source and free and everything. But unfortunately, the project died. But in the early days, I was asked to be the voice of Mycroft, and I recorded my voice for them, and they used it, and it didn't turn out great. And this was a few years ago, and somehow, my voice has been exported from Mycroft and it now lives on all over the place. And I keep getting messages from people who tell me that their voice assistant or their home assistant or their something or other talks to them in my voice, which has perplexed me for a while. But the problem is, it's not a very good quality voice when you compare it to some of the others. Mm-hmm. And when you compare it to things like Siri or the Google one, and other modern things that talk back to you. And this has kind of bothered me for a while because it's got my name on it and it's not a very high quality voice. So I've ruminated for a while thinking, how would I redo it? Because the original one was recorded using a third party proprietary service called Vocal ID. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they're even still around anymore, but I'd rather use something open. And it wasn't until I was just scrolling idly through the old social networks that I discovered there are tools to do this, and you can do it on your local workstation and turn your own voice into, I don't know, a What Are Beans machine or whatever you want to say with it.
So how long did it take you to do this the first time?
Well, too long and not long enough. Too long in that I didn't realize it was like quite a lot of sentences you have to say.
Right.
You're in a web page and you press a button and start recording a sentence that's on the screen. And then you hit stop recording and you listen to it and then you accept it. And there are a lot of these sentences. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say it took a long time was it took hours and hours and hours to do because there are thousands of sentences that you have to say.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say it's not long enough is because I rushed it a bit, which is partly why the audio doesn't sound great. So it's partly my own fault, but also the technology wasn't great. But I wanted to do an improved version. And what I discovered was, first of all, that there is a set of standard file formats for this kind of stuff.
Oh, really?
Yes, there is a thing called the LJ format. And this LJ format comes from the name of the first person who did this, whose name is Linda Johnson. And this is someone who worked at LibriVox, who did audiobooks, free audiobooks and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And she recorded thousands of phrases. And they converted those audio clips into a file format where there is the audio file and the text of what it is they said, the phrase. And these are mostly from out of copyright books from many, many years ago.
Yeah.
And so that's what people use. They create these files in that LJ format, which comes from her initials. And then they use that as training data to build a model. And obviously, the better the training data that you have, the better quality voice and the more phrases that are more diverse with all the different sounds that your mouth makes, the better. And so I looked for a tool to do this, and there is one. And there's two parts to it. The bit that you record your voice with, and then the second bit that turns that into training data. There's a few more steps than that, but that's basically it. And so the first part is called Piper Recording Studio. And Piper Recording Studio, it's basically a Python application that runs in a web page, and it just shows you a sentence, and you press R to record, and you say your phrase, and then you press F to stop recording, and then you can press P to play and listen to it. And if you like it, you can press S to save. So you end up in a little loop of going record and record a phrase, stop recording, listen to it, save it. And over time, you'll build up this corpus of recordings of you saying those things. And that's what happens in Piper Recording Studio.
So you say that Piper Recording Studio is a website. Is this a locally run thing, or is there a hosted Piper studio that you use to do this?
Yes. So the people who run it, I think they have their own instance, and you can submit your audio to that instance, or you could just run it yourself. It's just a little bit of Python, and you install it and run it. So once you've got that, you end up with a lot of WebP files, I guess, the audio files that get recorded by the browser. And there's an export utility that turns all those files into this LJ format that you can then use to feed the training set. And then there's this tool called Piper. And Piper has the ability to build the training data. And this is the bit that takes quite a bit of time in terms of CPU or GPU to do the processing and turn it into a file that you can then use to do the text to speech bit. So it's all quite time consuming. But now that I know how to do it, I wanted to set up an environment in which I could just, when I have half an hour, record, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 phrases and then save them up. And the interesting thing is, the more phrases you have, the better the voice gets, the better the training data, and the better the voice gets at the other end. But what's also interesting is you could train it at any time with 100 phrases or with 200 phrases. So what my plan is to see how much better it gets, because I haven't gone through the whole end-to-end process yet. What I want to do is record it a few phrases and see what the voice is like, and then do the training again with more. And the interesting thing is, when you do the training, it takes a checkpoint and you can build upon the existing set of phrases. So you don't have to retrain with the extra 100 phrases that you've said. You can just build on top of the checkpoint. And in fact, there are public checkpoints that you can take to build on top of to start with. And so you're effectively kind of retraining the model to your voice based on the bulk of work that somebody else has already done.
How does that work?
Well, I don't know.
Someone else's, okay.
I guess you end up with some sort of third combination voice.
I don't know what that's going to sound like, but I'm told it's a good idea to start with a checkpoint. Now, I could do both. You know, I could train it with a starting checkpoint and train it with my own voice and see what the difference is. And it all sounds great, but I had real trouble getting the software working because it's all written in Python, which, you know, great. I can just create a virtual environment and inside that I can run my Python. But it turns out it's actually a little bit trickier because some of the modules, the Python modules, are only built for Python 3.11 or only published for Python 3.11. And if you want to build them yourself, there's a whole bunch of dependencies. And I ended up going and grabbing tarballs and building stuff. And it was just horrible. And there is a Docker file in the repo. And I could just, you know, Docker run or Docker build or whatever. And I was really reluctant to use Docker. And then I tried. And, you know, sure enough, you just, you know, Docker build and it just works, right? Which is annoying. You know, my opposition to using Docker. The reason why I wasn't using Docker initially is because I was following a tutorial on YouTube. And in the tutorial, they didn't use Docker. They said, oh, you can do that, but I'm just going to SSH into my Ubuntu box and run through all the steps. And they just created a virtual environment and did everything within that. The problem was I'm now using a newer version of Ubuntu, which has newer Python. And so not everything works quite the same. And it's a little bit frustrating.
So you said that you build the training data, which then builds the voice model. I assume then you can like pump phrases into it and hear what it sounds like
Yes, that's exactly it. Once you've said all the words and then exported that out as LJ format and then fed that into Piper in order to build the training data. There's a bit of pre-processing and then build the training data. You can then point Piper at that voice file and say this, just like you would with any of the text-to-speech engines. You just give it a phrase and it will just say it in the voice that you've given it.
How many recorded phrases do you have to make before the model starts to sound like you?
That's a great question that I can't answer yet because I haven't recorded enough to be able to tell you.
Okay.
So I think that will be a follow-up that I'll come back to.
All right.
Once I've been able to record some. It actually was quite frustrating getting the install working, especially because I'm also doing it on my M1 Mac running right. Linux. So it's ARM64. Which was an extra stumbling block.
Yes.
Because not everything is available for ARM64. And so that was a little bit frustrating. And then at the very end, I noticed there's a binary build of Piper linked directly from their README. But because I was following a tutorial that said build from source, and then they also mentioned Docker, I just didn't see, my brain didn't see the binary build. Anyway, I saw the binary build, download it, unpack it, run it, works fine. So that's what I'm going to use from now on, is just use the binary build. And I will no doubt talk about this again in a future episode once I've got it recording. Or maybe my virtual assistant will be here and we'll talk to you instead.
We'll never know.
And maybe none of this was Alan at all.
Yes.
I've gone cold turkey and completely cut Google search out of my life.
How? How can you do that?
I know.
You're a Bing man.
No, not at all. This is going to be the interesting part of this, and I deliberately didn't share what I'm using instead with the two of you. So whilst I was away in America recently, I was working with two of my colleagues, and I noticed that my boss, Graham, was using a search engine called Kagi. So, or is it, it's either Kagi or Kagi, Kagi.com. I have no idea how you pronounce it, but that's what it is. And I was like, well, what's this? Why are you using that? And he was like, well, there's no adverts and it's privacy respecting and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then I was like, you've used this for a number of things and these search results are good. Unlike everything else I've tried in the past when I've thought, I think I might bounce off Google search because I don't like have to scroll down half a page to get past all the sponsored nonsense. And I'm not super keen on all of the fingerprinting that's going on. So having seen sort of half a day of this search engine spitting out really good quality results, I thought, I'm going to give this a try. So I have, and I'm very impressed. So I'm now 2 weeks in as having this as my default search engine on everything. So I think I'll just wind back a little bit and sort of explain how I sort of set this up. Kagi, I'm going to call it, requires you have an account. So you have to sign up. You can sign in with, I think, Apple and Google and something else, or you can create an account, but you have to have an account to use it. And they do have a free tier where you can have 100 searches a month. So you can try it out and see how it works before you have to pay for anything. But pay for something, if you like it, is what you have to do, because this is very much a funded business model. They are not an ad-supported platform at all, and they are also a privacy-respecting platform as well. So the whole business model is you pay money and they give you high-quality search results and no adverts whatsoever. And if that appeals to you, then you might want to give it a try.
I don't see any adverts on Google anymore now, thanks to like buttons I've pressed and extensions I've installed. But what I do see is rubbish responses like right. to my searches. And so I'm less bothered about the privacy and the advertising. I'm more bothered about the accuracy of the results.
Well, I've got good news for you, because there's a number of killer features in Kagi that I really like. So the first is that you can actually sort of tune the way it looks. So you can, it's got a number of options to guide how it displays the information, where summary information is, where URLs are presented. So you can craft that so it is to your preference. But I think the thing, Alan, that you will like most about this is that they have personalized results. And this can mean a couple of different things. But I think that the thing that I really like about it is this. First of all, when I search for things, like today I was searching for backpacks, and one of the results was Pinterest, a list of Pinterest things. That is of zero use to me whatsoever. And what you can do in Kaji is you can say, you know what, Pinterest, I never want to see results from Pinterest ever again. And in fact, when you go and look, that is the overwhelming result that everyone in Kaji is basically saying, never show me Pinterest in my search results.
Fancy that.
But also, nothing that Pinterest ever presents to me is useful. So I've turned it down. I've said, like, drop its priority. And then it has these things called lenses. So if I've asked a question about maybe a programming related question, lenses are sort of topic focused filters, if you like. So you can type your question, then say, put this on the programming lens, and it will then only give you results from websites that cater to that kind of content. And so as a result, you sort of get like a honed, more focused set of results by changing the lens that you look at the results through. And something else that I really like is they have this small web. It's a category, but it's more of a movement within Kaji. And it's a way to say, I want to highlight like high quality, well-written blog posts from individuals and independent people, as opposed to big tech articles, like commercially sponsored content. And that's really good for sort of getting into like really good results. Like I remember used to find really well-written blog posts in search results quite often, and they're few and far between now. It's always medium and they're rubbish. And so it's really nice to get back that web. And the Kaji mission is to humanize the web. And I really feel like they're delivering on that. The quality of the search results is, in my opinion, better than Google have been in recent years, because as Alan was saying, I've noticed a drop off in the applicability and usefulness of the Google search results. I feel like there's a lot of gaming the Google systems going on, and so it's become less relevant over time. So there's a free thing, you can try it out, 100 queries a month. That won't last you very long. I got through 98 very quickly.
Yeah, I would probably get through that in a day or so.
And then there's a $5 tier, which gives you 300 searches a month. And then there's a $10 tier, which is unlimited. And there may be something bigger than that, and I can't remember. But at the moment, I'm still using the $5 tier until I exhaust my 300. I was just interested to see how long 300 will take.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've got no idea how long it would take me to do 300 searches.
I did 98 in a day, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't use bookmarks, and so I use Google as my bookmark handler. And so I worry that I'm starting afresh with a new search engine, and it wouldn't know the things that, you know, I actually want to find.
Well, you can try it out at zero risk and see how it goes. I've switched and I'm very happy with the outcome. I love the fact that the first result is immediately relevant. I don't have to do that scroll past all of the cruft that gets inserted. I like the fact I've been able to tune the results to my preference, because Kaji are there to make my search experience better, not to service their ad revenue or whatever it might be. They have a zero telemetry iOS browser. I think it's called Orion or Orion Plus or something. But because Kaji is open search compliant, I've just been able to integrate it into my existing browsers.
What's open search?
It's that URL format where you have like question mark Q equals search terms.
So you can just add that as a search thing in any browser or tool.
Oh, okay. I wasn't familiar with this.
Yeah, there's a format for the actual search term, and there's another format for I'm doing an image search, and there's another format for I'm doing search suggestions via an API. And in the browser configuration policies, this is how you insert like another browser search into the list of known search providers.
Okay, right, got it. It's like a standard endpoint that search engines implement, and then applications which do searches can have a known way of doing it with each search engine. Got it.
Exactly. Exactly so.
I can hear the keyboards being spun up right now of people writing to us and saying, yeah, but what about, and then listing all the DuckDuckGo start page and all the others that everyone already knows about. Mm-hmm. Don't need to tell us about those. We know about those.
Yeah.
But is there any reason you should use this over those, or someone should consider this over those?
So most of those others are ad-supported business models. So you don't get away from adverts entirely, because they insert the adverts into their platform that they deem appropriate. Also, DuckDuckGo and Quant and one of the others, I forget who it was, got in some hot water because it turned out, despite their privacy claims, they are actually siphoning off a load of data to Microsoft. So it wasn't indeed fully privacy respecting. So they've had a bit of a hard time. So you can use them. And if they give you good quality results, which I have never seen from any of them, then fine. But Kaji, great search results, better than I've had with Google for a long while. And I'm prepared to pay for a better service. So that's what I've chosen to do.
I spent an evening last week judging a coding competition for kids.
Interesting. How many entrants were in this coding competition?
Well, I didn't have to judge all of them. They were sort of chunked up. So
the coding or the children?
The games were chunked up, not the participants. But so that I think each game got judged by a few people, so that you didn't have like a list of 100 for everyone to judge. This is a competition called the Young Coders Competition 2024, which has been running for a few years. I got involved in it through the STEM Ambassadors program. So STEM Ambassadors is like a national program in the UK, which aims to promote learning in science, technology, engineering, and maths by finding people in the industry to volunteer their time to help out schools and clubs and so on do things around computing and science and technology. And one of the things that ambassadors have been involved in this year is judging this competition. So I got sent basically a spreadsheet with links to Scratch games published online, and my job was to go and play them and mark them according to the sort of technical aspects of the game, the aesthetics of the game, and the, I think it's called, community responsibility, which is things like, does it fit with the theme of the competition, and is it appropriate for the age range?
So what was the theme?
The theme this year was time and space.
Did you get any Doctor Who related entries?
I was really hoping there would be a Doctor Who one.
Hot tub time machine, maybe.
There wasn't one in my batch of games, unfortunately. But yeah, it was interesting to see how the theme was interpreted by the various people. And it was also, most of the stuff I've done through STEM Ambassadors before with kids coding has been Python with the BBC Micro bit. I've done a little bit of Scratch, but not too much. So it was really interesting to see what people came up with. The age range of this was 7 to 13-year-olds, and they work in teams of between 2 and 6 people.
Oh, they were teams, not individuals?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was all done using Scratch. So the way I did this was, you got given the Scratch page, which has the game embedded in it, and there's a text field they can put instructions and notes. So I would read the instructions first and then play the game and see how I got on. And then I'd go and look at the code and see if I understood, if I could see how it was written, if there was anything particularly impressive in there, anything that looked particularly odd that I could provide constructive feedback on and things like that. All in all, I think everyone who I judged had basically, they all got the hang of Scratch. They knew how to use it. They knew how to make a game. Well, they knew how to make a program in it, is what I'd say. They knew how to do something, make stuff appear on screen, move around, display text, and so on. Some of them had done like a really impressive program, but not necessarily a particularly good game. So there were a few which were sort of a long animation or a long piece of like interactive fiction without many particular gameplay elements, but they were telling a story. They'd fitted all of this in with the theme of, you know, time and space. There were some time travel stories where you go to the past and do something and then go to the future and do something else, or you know, you're exploring space and you go around and learn things about space. But there were a few which took a sort of more focused approach where they just picked a particular like simple game and then themed that around time and space and just made it work really well. So there were a couple where they'd done a sort of a single player Pong game with a planet as the ball.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, you hit it and it bounces off around the screen and you have to catch it as many times as possible. And then some have a timer and some have a score and some have both. You know, it was nice to see, as well as someone who's not that familiar with Scratch, actually how straightforward things like that are, doing, you know, have it animate and fly around the screen and do collision detection and have that all work. And it actually feels quite slick to play, considering how simple it is to put together.
It does amaze me and please me how far we've come. Like, many years ago on the Ubuntu podcast, we interviewed the people behind Code Club, and they were very Scratch oriented and, you know, teaching kids how to use Scratch. But now, like, having teams of children where you've got enough children to field a team who can work together collaboratively on a game and share it online for other people to play with is just blows my mind that we've come from the IT education in the system, which was here's a spreadsheet, here's a word processor, to this is amazing.
Mm. It is really cool. I think my favorite entry actually had a whole intro animation that then went into essentially an asteroids kind of game and then had a whole separate game. I guess maybe they'd worked as a team and they'd each taken a different bit of it and then put them all together.
Right.
But I was sitting there thinking, oh, it's another animation. And then it like went into the main game as well. And it was like properly interactive. And yeah, it's really interesting to see what people came up with.
Yeah, I can totally see how you could have a team collaborating that way. My daughter's been into Scratch for a number of years now. And her friends, they use the backpack feature of Scratch to sort of bundle up something they've been working on and share it so that they can then integrate it into some other project that somebody else has been working on. And this is how they sort of fork code and share it within the Scratch sort of platform. It's very effective.
Nice. Yeah.
How many entries were there in total?
Oh, I don't actually know how many there were in total. I think I judged, something around a dozen of them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But yes, I don't know because I only saw my bit of it.
You don't get to see the results then?
So the way it works is the STEM ambassadors are doing this judging and each of the three criteria I mentioned get a score assigned to them. And then I think the entries that score the highest then go and get judged by the previous winners, which are actually a group of school kids who have done very well in previous years are going to be the final judging panel who are going to then play all the games and provide the final results. So once I find out who the winners are, I'll post them on probably on Mastodon or something.
Excellent.
I'm not sure. I this has been running for a few years now, so hopefully it'll be running again next year, but I'll also share details once I find out what's going on with the next year's competition.